This episode of the Blackzit Global Podcast is sponsored by Blackzit Global Passport. Join aspiring Black expats, and repats, where you can build community, get resources, and gain support along your journey abroad. You're invited to join Blackzit Global Passport. Inside Passport, you'll find exclusive workshops on everything from expat taxes, financial planning, insurance, job boards, accountability check-ins, and more. You can even take Passport on the go with our app available for iOS and Android devices. Just click the link in the episode you're listening to or visit blackzitglobal.com and click on Passport. See you inside.
The Black woman experience of being an entrepreneur, especially in the restaurant industry and especially abroad in another country, it is all a mental game. You know, especially the first year, and I think because there were so many things that I didn't know, and it would have been a challenge in the U.S., but then once you're here and you're adding on a language barrier, different culture, different laws, like there's so many things, cultural customs. There were times, yeah, where I would be up at like 3 o'clock in the morning crying because I don't know how I'm going to make it. I don't know how I'm going to do this. Like I already put so much money into this. And, you know, if it does fail, what am I going to do? Like, what actually am I going to do next? I don't want to go back to my parents' house. I don't want to go back to the U.S. So what happens if this doesn't work out?
Close your eyes and imagine living a life you love, unapologetic and unbothered, free from daily microaggressions from Karens and Kens, free from the fear of police brutality and systemic racism. Wouldn't that feel amazing? Now open your eyes. What if I told you that it's possible? Hear inspiring stories and get the actual blueprints from brothers and sisters of the diaspora who are living out their wildest dreams abroad. You've heard the term, now be inspired by the movement. I'm Krishan Wright, and this is Blackzit Global.
Y'all, I'm excited for this episode of the Blackzit Global Podcast because my next guest has been lighting it up in Mexico City. I have the pleasure of speaking with Tierra Darnell, who is the owner and executive chef at Blackzit Cocina, Mexico City's first and only Black-owned soul food restaurant. And she is joining me today from Mexico City. Hey, Tierra.
Hey, hey, hey. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you are here. Oh, my goodness. I have been following you for quite some time and seeing the amazing, amazing things that you've been doing in Mexico City. Those that listen to the podcast know that I have yet to travel to Mexico. But when I do, I'm going to Mexico City, and I know I'm going to Blackzit Cocina. But before we get into that remarkable part of your journey and story, I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about your origin story, because when I, you know, when people tell me their stories, it usually reveals so much of where they are in present day. So would love it if you would start wherever you're comfortable.
Well, I came to Mexico City 3 years ago, this month actually. And I came down here thinking that I would be here for 6 months just on a tourist visa. It was 2021, so a year after the pandemic had started. And I was living at the time in Buffalo, New York, which is kind of where I got stuck during the pandemic. I'm actually from the Washington, D.C., Maryland, D.C. area originally, but I was there and I realized that Buffalo, like, no disrespect, I love the people and my friends that I met there, but Buffalo is not the city for me. It is not the climate for me. It is not the physical, like, or geographical location for me. It's just not. And so after a year there, I decided that I wanted to do something different. I came down here, like I said, thinking I would be here for 6 months and I would probably find somewhere else in the U.S. to live, but I just kept extending my time here. And I should mention that I also came down here clandestinely because my employer did not know that I was down here, you know, for the first 9 months that I came to Mexico. And so I came down here and I was working clandestinely. My employer didn't know I was down here. And I, yeah, just found myself in a situation where probably, like it's happened to some folks, the job that I had, I ended up getting laid off and I was already where I was. So I just decided to stay. And that became like my baseline. Okay, I know that I like it here. I know that I want to continue to live in Mexico. How do I do that? And so like, I don't have any background in cooking or restaurants or anything like that. I'm definitely somebody that I like to say is ancestrally trained. You know, I grew up cooking with the matriarchs in my family and their recipes came from, you know, the mothers before them. So these are all family recipes and things like that, that I just grew up cooking with folks in my family and for get-togethers and car parties and stuff like that back at home in PG County. So my initial plan was to do pop-ups. I did pop-ups off the roof of my apartment for about 9 months. And might I tell you, like, my kitchen is so tiny. Like, the very first Soul Food Sunday that I did, I think we had like 65, 70 people who showed up. And thank God I had all that roof space. But the kitchen is so tiny. But I pulled it off and cooked for all those people. And we had such a great time. And I think that that is when I really realized that not only do I have something here, because there is no soul food in Mexico City, like, well, not from authentic Black American, you know, soul food. There's some people out there trying. But that said, that's when I knew that I had something there. And also, like, something, when I say it, I mean, also for me, like, I really enjoyed seeing all these people come to my home and enjoy the food and enjoy being with each other. And, you know, like, when people get together for cookouts or whatever it might be, like, it's always a vibe because people just feed off of each other's energy and it just feels so safe and like nostalgic and like all those things that you miss about home, especially as a Black person abroad, Black from the US, like, that just all those things came together for me on that day. And so I kept doing the pop-ups. And I was working freelance at the time as well, still doing like audio production, which is what my background had been in, podcasts and that sort of stuff. And I had one more thing happen where I didn't get laid off, but somebody above me quit. And the trickle down effect was that my job was affected by that departure. And so that was like for the second time within a year that my finances, my well-being, my vision of stability for myself was affected by somebody else's decision. And so I think that that was really the push for me that made me realize, like, okay, you know what? I'm tired of being somebody else's collateral damage. I need to do something that is my own. If I want to stay here in Mexico, I can't keep depending on these remote jobs and, you know, working for other people, because none of it is, everything is, you're hired at will. So if you're hired at will, that does not mean that your job is going to be there tomorrow. That's not a given. And so for me, it was just like, I would rather struggle and start to build my own thing and do something that I've never really allowed myself to do, because I have very vivid memories of telling my dad that I wanted to go to culinary school, but I just didn't because of where I grew up. You know, everybody worked for the government or they were in the military or this and that. So I didn't really think that the culinary arts or, you know, like restaurant entrepreneurship, like that was something. I don't think it wasn't that I didn't think I couldn't do it. It was more just like I didn't think that that was going to lead me to a stable life. But then I did everything the way I was supposed to, the grad school, the corporate job, this and that. And that didn't actually lead me to a stable life either. So it just became one of those things where it's just like, all right, well, if I'm going to be unstable, at least I'm going to be the one, you know, behind that. And I'm going to be the one driving the direction that I want to go in. And so that's sort of like the background story of how I came to be here, why I stayed, how I jumped into the precursor to Black Cocina, which was the Soul Food Sundays. And then honestly, just walking across the park right out here, down the street from where I live, having a conversation similar to this one. I looked up and saw this for rent sign at the location where Black Cocina is now, right next to the park, 3 minutes walking from my house. And I just jumped all in and was like, you know what, let's just do it. And so it's been a year last month of February that Black Cocina has been open and operating, and it is truly a testament to community, to naivete and just doing the thing, even when you don't know exactly what you're doing, and just figuring it out and really taking a chance on yourself, even if it feels like something that's big and scary.
I'd say, I mean, there's so much in your story. I'm trying to figure out like where is the right entry point, because there was so much that you said that I loved. One was ancestrally trained, you know, and the thread into soul food, starting at those pop-ups. And that was like the origin of soul food, right? Good for your soul. And you are pouring into people, they're coming in, and you're just, you know, having that community, having the food, pulling it off in a tiny kitchen. But then with all of those things that were out of, you know, your control, with, you know, layoffs and the uncertainty around the pandemic and even employment, and betting on yourself, I'm just thoroughly in awe and inspired by what you've done so far, and congratulations on making it 1 year. So there was something that you said about wanting to do something in the culinary art, right? Because food was always central to, you know, your family, but the environment in the U.S. And I think part of that, at least for me, as I'm listening to you, is things are cost prohibitive, you know, for doing something like what you're doing right now, even where you came from, right? In Prince George's County, Maryland. So I guess my question is, how, when you looked at that space, when you decided on this venture, was that part of like in the equation of your mind, like, okay, you know what, whether I succeed or I fail, like, it's not going to be the end of the world if it fails?
Yeah, I would say my dad was in the Air Force. He's retired Air Force. And so I grew up, we didn't travel around. My mom was sort of like, Uncle Sam picked you, not us. So he went wherever he went, and we just, you know, stayed. But I think that his guidance and his sort of like, you know how dads are, like the life lessons always, whenever you, even when you don't need, you didn't even ask for a word, they're gonna give you a word. But he always told me that you can be proud of yourself if you've done something, you've done the absolute best you can do, and it still fails. It's not always, it will hurt, and you have to go through those feelings. Failure stings, but also there's always lessons to be learned in failure. So I think it was a combination of having that perspective instilled in me, and then also to knowing that, do I want to go home and live with my family? No. But if I absolutely had to, is that door going to be there for me? Yes. And so if I fail and I can't stay in Mexico, it might be a thing where, you know, I have to go back to DC, and I'm gonna have to live in the basement for a little bit. It won't take me that long, because I already know what the dynamic will be when I get there. So I'm gonna find some plan quick to get out and do my own thing. But if I needed to, I do know that safety net is there. And so I think a lot of times, and this is just like people in general, like sometimes we can be afraid to do something because it is that, what if I fail? But also, like, your community is there for you, and they're not going to let you fail. They're not going to let you be on the street. I'll say that, you know? So, and people spend so much time just, I don't know, talking themselves out of doing things. And so I think sometimes just like allowing ourselves to just do the thing and try it. And if it's not for you, you'll also probably learn pretty quickly, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. So now you can X that off of the list and move on to the other stuff. But I have really tried to live my life being a person that's not looking back saying like, what if? And so we only talked about like my origin story, getting here and starting the restaurant in Mexico. But even before that, I did do some government work, but then I also went and did the Peace Corps and lived in Morocco for 2 years. I also left Morocco and went to work in the Oregon wine industry because I thought that would be cool, and did that for, you know, 6 months. And I've worked in city government in Portland. I've worked in dispensaries. I was Oregon's bud tender of the year in like 2017 or 2018. So, I mean, like, I think that And especially like my dad being from that military background doesn't always understand my choices. My family doesn't always understand my choices. But I know that what I'm actually doing is like circling around something and getting closer to whatever that thing is that I don't recognize. Like, this is what I want to be doing. And I believe that Black Seat Cocina is that. But I just had to go for a real long walk around the park to figure out that this thing that I had been telling my dad since I was tiny, like, I love cooking, I want to go to culinary school. I'm not going to culinary school, but I just jumped in all, you know, with all I had to give and opened up a restaurant. And so this has been a crash course in business, communications, bilingual, interpersonal communication, like all of that stuff. So I'm getting it all at once. But I do think that all the things that I experienced leading up to this point really have allowed me to be able to do this successfully, even though I'm not doing it perfectly.
And that's the thing that's really important, is do it afraid, but do it anyway. 100%. And there is no such thing as perfection, right? Perfection is elusive and it's a thief of joy. And
I'm a Capricorn, so I'm used to thieves of joy. And like, don't tell me it's not going to be perfect. I have to come to that realization myself. But yes, it's always about trying to get to as close to perfection as possible.
Exactly. Exactly. And I even, you know, I can relate. I did not have a linear progression in terms of career. It was whatever I felt like I wanted to pursue in the moment. Didn't make sense to a lot of people. Even my move didn't make sense to a lot of people. But I feel like the more we can pay attention to part of ourselves and listen to that inner voice, that inner compass, that leads you where you need to go. And like you said, sometimes it's, you know, walk around the park to get there. But the more we can tune into that, the less we'll go off in directions that we don't need to go, really.
Right. And the other thing that I think is not often talked about, or I don't always hear these stories, they don't come to the forefront, at least the Black woman experience of being an entrepreneur, especially in the restaurant industry, and especially abroad in another country, it is all a mental game. It is all a mental game. There have been times where, you know, especially the first year, and I think because there were so many things that I didn't know, and it would have been a challenge in the U.S., but then once you're here and you're adding on a language barrier, different culture, different laws, like there's so many things, cultural customs. There were times, yeah, where I would be up at like 3 o'clock in the morning crying because I don't know how I'm going to make it. I don't know how I'm going to do this. Like, I already put so much money into this. And, you know, if it does fail, what am I going to do? Like, what actually am I going to do next? I don't want to go back to my parents' house. I don't want to go back to the U.S. So what happens if this doesn't work out? And I've been lucky. And I think it all, again, comes down to, like, you know, a lot of us don't get financial education in schools or even from our parents. And that's a whole other conversation about why that is. But I think that my parents taught me, if not to be offensive about my finances, at least to be good at defense. And so I think that that has helped out a lot. And so I've learned, you know, okay, I can't do this right now, but I can do this. Or I'm just going to have to suck it up and do this because otherwise it's going to lead to this other challenge later on. So, you know, everything is really about just prioritizing and making the best decision with the information that you have in the moment. But I think that that was something that I definitely didn't think a lot about, or, you know, kind of underestimated the emotional roller coaster of opening a new business. And like I said, especially a restaurant, because they are, like, you know, it is one of the hardest, if not the hardest industry out there to be an entrepreneur in. And so many restaurants fail after, you know, 3 months, 6 months. So to be here a year is truly tremendous. And I don't think that I always stop to give myself, I don't think I've ever even said that phrase out loud. Like, this is truly tremendous. You know, like, I just am so focused on myself and what I'm doing and just going because I have this vision, like I said, for what I want the business to be, that I don't always give myself the grace to like celebrate the small wins and the milestones and this and this, because sometimes I just don't have the bandwidth to do it, which is why like our 1 year celebration happened kind of like a month after it probably should have, you know, but it's, I did it when I could get around to it. Okay. Like, you know, great. Now we can celebrate a year and 1 month of a success. But I think that that's something that has, like I said, not, I haven't always heard a lot of stories of women talking about like just the emotional toll that doing something like this takes on you. And that's just like the business. And then there's like the relationship side of it. I definitely have, you know, some folks that we were like kind of friends before, but then when I got into the business and everything became so all consuming with the restaurant, like those friendships, if they were strong, they're still around. And if they weren't, then they're really not in my orbit in the same way that they were, you know, when I first, before I started this journey and when I was just here and kind of enjoying my time with little stress about what I was going to do and where my money was coming from and this and that. So I think that that has definitely been something that I still work through, still continue to like, you know, think about. And like I said, yeah, it doesn't really get talked about that often, but I do think it's something that if you're planning to open a business anywhere, but especially abroad, you know, making sure that the tribe of people around you is like rock solid and that you're not spending energy on people who are not really worth that time and energy. That's, you know, that's resources. That's a natural resource too. Your energy, your emotional bandwidth, that has to be there because you're going to need it in abundance. And you're going to need it sometimes when you have a deficit. So how deep is your well, even when it's in the negative? Like you have to be able to stay strong and make sure that the people around you are really, you know, lifting you up and that they're forgiving and gracious when you can't always maybe extend the same to them because of the circumstances that you're in the moment. So I think that that's something that, you know, even in interviews, like nobody really asks about, but I think it's something like worth, you know, talking about. And also just being real that, you know, sometimes it's, you have to be isolationist when it comes to your business and really just cut out all of the extra stuff and just focus on honing the thing that you're working on. And I learned that early on because of course, when I started, I wanted, and I still am, like everything I'm doing is about community and I want to be collaborative. But I also think that especially in the beginning, even before the beginning, when I was doing the pop-ups on the roof of my house, I don't think anybody really like took me seriously in some ways. Like they, like it was, oh, okay, she's doing that thing. Like, okay, whatever, that's cool. But then when I had the physical location and then suddenly there was like a restaurant, oh, there's a restaurant, there's a brand behind it, there's this and this. Then suddenly it was like, okay, well, can you come do this for me? Like, how about you do that? And I said yes in the beginning. And then after like three times where I realized like how much stressing me out trying to do a pop-up over here for somebody and cater, you know, a party of 150, 200 people from, you know, 6 p.m. until 3 o'clock in the morning. Like there's stuff like that that I just can't do. And I'm one person. And I also have a team of people who are relying on me to lead them, to give them the best guidance possible. And then all the people who are coming to the restaurant who expect a certain level of experience. I can't do all that and do this over here and stay sane, have time for myself. So I had to learn to say no to a lot of things and to some people who otherwise I wouldn't have said no to. But once I realized like, okay, this is not sustainable and it's actively hurting you and is preventing you from growing your business, which is actually where your primary responsibility is, then it became clear to me like, okay, I can't do all those other things. I have to focus on this. And when I stop trying to please everybody else and do all these extra things that really were benefiting them more so than they were benefiting me, then it became easier for me to grow Black Sigo Cena into what it is now. But I had to learn those lessons and lose some money. And honestly, like, you know, I don't want to say like lose some friendships, but those friendships definitely evolved into something different than they were. Those things had to happen for me to learn those lessons that have benefited the business that I have now. And that's also something that's really important.
Absolutely, because it's a huge level of, as I'm listening to you, maturity, wisdom, and discernment, right? Because when you're in the moment and these things are happening and you're trying to run this business, people are depending on you, you're also in another country, like all the things are happening all at once, it can be an emotional overload. And then not to have, you know, the right supports or even be able to know like who's a friend and who might be a frenemy, you know, or foe.
Yeah. But I think in general, like people always mean well, but it's just kind of one of those things where unless you've experienced something, then you can't really fully understand what it's like for the person on the other side of it. And so people, all they see is, I want this and I want you to give it to me like that. And I think a lot of times, like, I'm an eager person. I want to please. I want to do a good job. But also, I had to be real with myself. Like, okay, now that these two or three different events have happened, what have you learned? Okay, well, doing pop-ups is not going to be easy for me because, one, I don't have the team. I don't have the bandwidth. And especially doing things where they're happening on the same days where the restaurant is open, I can't. If I'm comfortable saying, all right, I'm not going to sleep for 48 hours, that's my choice. But most of the time, that is not what I want to be doing with my time. Like, I need to sleep. I need to rest. I need to do things that bring people into the restaurant that I've spent so much money on. And I need to do that not only because that's why I created Black Scocina, but also because, again, I have this whole other team that I have to support. So me stressing them is going to affect the experience that you have walking in the door and sitting down at a table at Black Scocina. And so if I can't give the people who are coming to me for the Black Scocina experience what they want, then I definitely can't do it for somebody else somewhere else because I just don't have the bandwidth, you know, to execute those things effectively at this time. Now, maybe year 3, 4, 5, something like that, we see what this, you know, investor journey brings, then maybe when I can have, you know, more team and I can get to a point where I can go away for the weekend and go do some other things and not have to worry that, oh snap, like, you know, we ran out of chicken or, oh, we ran out of, you know, blue Kool-Aid or, you know, whatever it is, you know? So there's just like, there's so many things. Oh, the lights aren't working. You know, the plumbing in the kitchen backed up. The refrigerator is failing. Like, there's so many different things that are always constantly happening to be on top of. I gotta focus on right here at home and get this right so that way I can do the other things later on. But that was a lesson that I had to learn it the hard way and it had to happen 3 times for me to just realize, like, bigger picture, this is not working. So what is working is when you are focused on what is right here in front of you and what is the most important. And that other stuff, if people are understanding, it'll still be there. The opportunity will still be there. They'll come around again. And the people who aren't understanding, they'll go find someone else to go do it with. And that's okay. That is perfectly fine. But yeah, that wasn't very obvious to me right from the jump.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great lesson to pass on. And so one obvious one coming out of that is with all the hats that you're wearing and juggling, how have you been able to partake in self-care? You know, how do you make sure that you have the oxygen mask on you?
I don't. I mean, I would say that in terms of self-care, you know, I have wanted to move from like where I live now for a while because I wanted to lower my cost of living. So, you know, that was one option, or getting a roommate. But at the end of the day, like, I deal with people and I'm a people person. Like, I do love people and being around people, meeting new people, but I also need my alone time to recharge and be on and to have that energy. So me, like, doing what I can do to stay in the situation where I don't have to have a roommate and, you know, moving obviously costs money as well, first and last. And then you never know what your landlord situation is going to be. Like, all this stuff, like, I've tried to hang on to what I have so that way I can take care of myself in that way. Like, I can control my environment. I can come home and it can just be me. Or, you know, if my boyfriend's here, whatever, then, you know, that's another thing. But, like, for the most part, this is my home, my environment, my peace away from the restaurant. And so that, honestly, just finding a way, even when it's been very difficult to maintain paying for my spot and not having to have a roommate to offset that cost, that has been huge for me. I don't think that it's enough. I do feel like, you know, it would be nice to go to the beach. There's beaches in Mexico. I haven't seen one in like a year and a half, and I don't have plans anytime soon, you know, to go to one. So that kind of stuff that I could do before I had the restaurant, I haven't been able to afford to do it now. And that's the kind of stuff that those little tiny mental health breaks, like those things are definitely needed. But I don't take enough care of myself as I should. But I also think if you ask any entrepreneur that's doing something that's extremely difficult, that's just kind of the sacrifice that you make, especially, you know, probably for the first 3 years of the business. So I do what I can do where I can, but a lot of times that for me is just being at home. And sometimes it can mean doing my laundry and feeling good about like taking care of my stuff, my personal stuff, and getting my environment and like everything fixed. And sometimes it's just like, you know what? I'm not doing that laundry. I'm not doing these dishes. I'm just going to be here at home in my mess and just rest. And I'll deal with all those other things later. So sometimes, yeah, it means just doing nothing. And I think Mondays are probably like the only day that I can do that. But, you know, that was a choice I made. So here I am.
So I'm curious, because now that I live in Portugal, I've become quite the foodie. And one of the things that I realize that just in my own, you know, cooking is, you know, ingredients aren't always the easiest thing to find. There's certain things that, you know, are near and dear to my heart. As someone who has Southern roots, I like my grits. That's one of the big ones. But there are certain, you know, creature comfort that I can't find just with me living myself in Lisbon. And so I imagine with you having now a restaurant and soul food, which, you know, there's a lot of food. I'm thinking collard greens, cornbread, all those things. How have you been able to think about, you know, ingredients and finding things? Because you did mention there's a language barrier, right? So how did you go about that?
Well, I do speak Spanish, not fluently, but at a pretty advanced level. But I also think a lot of this goes back to, I kind of glossed over, but those 2 years I lived in Morocco when I was doing the Peace Corps, I would say there was probably even a greater gap between being able to make the things that I wanted to make with ingredients that I was used to back in the States there than probably even here in Mexico City. And so I think, you know, for living there for 2 years, and especially because I live in a very rural area of Morocco, southern Morocco, that I learned how to adapt. And I remember like the first time I wanted to make, I lived with the host family for a little bit, and the first time I wanted to make something for them, and I was thinking about like, what ingredients are they already cooking with that I can just make something where they can recognize the ingredients, even if it's prepared in a different way. And so, and also something that was easy. And so I thought about chili, like, you know, it's meat, it's beans, you eat it over rice, you know, you can have it with cornbread. Did not think about the fact that like, I wasn't going to be able to find cornmeal as easily, especially because at that time I was even in a more rural area when I was living with the host family. It was a tiny, tiny town. And so I had to go get corn, find a way to blend it. Thank God they had a blender. And so I had to like make my own cornmeal. So I could find something that was similar to cornmeal, but it wasn't the right consistency and the cornbread wasn't coming out the way it was supposed to. And so that is a lesson right there in having to do things from scratch. Same thing like pie crust. When I wanted to make a pie, like this isn't run out to the store real quick and go buy a Pillsbury pie crust you can just roll out. Like, no, you got to start with the butter and the flour. And maybe at that point I didn't have, you know, a food processor. So now I got to like, you know, do that dough by hand and this and that. And there is no pastry cutter. So I'm using a fork, you know, so you just adapt And so I think that that was early training for, again, it wasn't culinary school in the traditional, I guess, sense of going to like a school where you have a teacher and you learn things, but I'm learning from the environments around me, around the tools around me, and from, you know, Moroccan women, and just doing things with what you have. And so I think for me, things like that have really helped here. So we do grind our own corn for the cornbread, because same thing, I couldn't find grits when I first got here. So we're grinding corn for the cornbread, we're grinding corn for grits, we're grinding the corn for hush puppies, you know, we're grinding the corn so we can make our own fish fry from scratch. There is no shake and bake or whatever, like Louisiana fish fry here, that kind of stuff. And it's too much of a pain in the butt to get somebody to bring it every single time. And then you got the people in customs looking at this bag of like fish fry, like, what is this, you know? So it's just, it's like too much. And so you have to kind of like figure out these things for yourself. And that's pretty much what we've done. Some things that are harder, Old Bay seasoning is one. But I happened to mention in another interview off the cuff that that was something that I was struggling to get. And McCormick reached out and they sent me a ton of Old Bay right here to Mexico. So that was really, really amazing. And I really thank them for that. What else? Collard greens. I'm very lucky that someone in the restaurant community here told me about a farmer who was accidentally growing collard greens. Like, I was told that he thought he was growing kale, and I don't know where he got these seeds from and got them confused. And it turns out that he had collard greens. And so I started buying him out every single week. And then when I went home, I guess at this point, like 2 years ago in February, I connected with the Heirloom Collard Project in Southern Virginia, and they sent me 5 different varieties of collard green seeds. Like, I had no idea that there were 5 different, there's over 100 different varieties of collard greens. I had only been aware of one, but now we have 5, and I'm working with a local farmer here to grow them and to be able to sell them. And so that's like creating economic opportunity that works not just for me in the restaurant, but also for this farmer, who now, with all the Black people coming to Mexico who are looking for those future comforts, he has one thing that is important to Black culture and food that nobody else has. So that's a point of differentiation for him and his business that, you know, is going to help him out too. So stuff like that, those are kind of like the main things that come up for me in terms of ingredients that have had to have some kind of story behind how we got there with them. And then blue Kool-Aid, that blue raspberry Kool-Aid. I can't find that flavor here. That is something I do have to get people to bring in. I always tell folks, like, if you get me one of them 48 packs of the blue Kool-Aid on Amazon and you come down, I will comp your meal. Like, we need that for one of our main drinks. And so that has been like really important too. And, you know, it's kind of funny to think about, like, you know, whoa, this Kool-Aid is imported. This shit is fancy, but it is imported Kool-Aid. And it is very important to Black Cicosina.
Oh, wow. So y'all that are listening, you heard it here. Tierra said, blue Kool-Aid. So if you're coming down to Mexico City, you're doing a scouting trip, trying to bring some extra stuff. Hopefully you won't have any issues with customs.
Nope. The little packets is fine. That's fine. They know what Kool-Aid is.
Good.
Yeah, bring me that 48 pack and be good.
Yeah, but I love, you know, the story with the farmer and the different, I didn't know there were different types of collard greens, and even how that McCormick collaboration came together. That is fascinating. And it really just reinforces, like, when you go in the direction of your dreams, you don't need to know that how everything's going to work out. You just need to be taking action, and things start to manifest and show up in a way that if you even thought about how to engineer that, it may not work out. Like, some people would think, oh, you know what? If I want to open up a restaurant, I need to then go to culinary school and learn how to do the business part of it. Maybe I want to get a certificate in running a restaurant and all those things. You saw an opportunity. You had a skill and a passion that you chose to tap into. And of course, with Mexico City being a beautiful backdrop, and now all of these people that are coming far and wide to partake in that, it's just a beautiful story.
Yeah, no, it's been really amazing. And honestly, I would say, especially because I had students, high school students recently come to the kitchen, some who are interested in like restaurant ownership and entrepreneurship and that kind of thing and cooking. I told them, I was like, don't even go to culinary school. You can get an internship in a restaurant and go learn, or you can travel even better and go learn from people in different places how to make their food. Go to school for business. And it doesn't even have to be like a four-year institution. Even just going to like community college and taking some classes, you know, learn how to get comfortable with Excel, learn how to make a budget, learn how to cost out a recipe. Like, those are the kind of things that no matter where you go and what industry you're in, knowing how to just like understand numbers and like basic like principles of business will serve you in so many different capacities.
Absolutely. So with that, you know, because I try to balance the all the great stuff that happens, but being realistic, right? Everything isn't popcorn and lollipop, as I like to say. So what have been some of the challenges? I know we talked about, you know, sourcing ingredients, that you talked about being really nimble and agile and figuring it out from earlier experiences abroad. But what are some of the challenges that you think as you're, you know, building the plane, as you're flying it with the restaurant? I've seen pictures of Black's Cocina. We follow each other on Instagram. The exterior is beautiful. And I'm curious at how, you know, that whole thing came together. But what have been some of the things that you're like, oh, this is how it works? Or maybe learning opportunities, you know, things that you can say, oh, you know what, I get feedback from someone and maybe there's something I could do differently. What are some of those challenges?
I mean, I think the earliest challenges for being even in a very cosmopolitan city like Mexico City, the culture in Mexico is like, there is Mexicans and they have Mexican national cuisine. And so like when you grow up in there's diversity in Mexico, but like just for the sake of like this conversation, when you grow up in like a homogenous environment and you also grow up in a country that has a national cuisine, much like I'm sure Portugal, most of the old world countries like in Europe, everybody has that. And even in other places that are not the West, like they have a national cuisine. The U.S. doesn't really have that because we're such a country of so many different people. And so we're so used to eating. Like, I can go get Thai food tonight. I can go get, you know, Indian food the next day or like whatever. So there's just such a abundance of choice. And so here, I do think that people are more open and interested in trying other things. But also they kind of need to see like, but did y'all over here try it first? And they need like, you know, the cosign of their people, much the same way Black people need a cosign from each other. Like, yeah, now you got to go here. You know, so it was very hard in the beginning. Because I think a lot of people, and still a lot of people, don't know what soul food is here in Mexico City. And I've realized I think that they know what it is, but they don't realize they know what it is. Because KFC has been here, Popeyes has been here, and Popeyes has grown exponentially in like 2 years here. They didn't have it when I first got here. And so I think that, you know, people are aware of what mac and cheese is and like, you know, but there's a lot of, and they obviously consume a lot of like Black culture, like music and that sort of stuff here, but nobody's ever like put it together that like these things go hand in hand. And like, yeah, y'all love, you know, Beyonce, Kendrick Lamar is about to be here in 2 weeks doing a performance. So you all love this culture. What are those people eating? What did they grow up eating? Like, you know, and all the things that come with that Blackness. So it's a new concept for a lot of people, you know, for a country that, let's face it, realistically is not completely in charge or not completely in touch with understanding the history of like Afro-Mexicans. Why would I expect them to know the history of Black Americans from the US? So this is a lot of newness for a lot of people in a time of newness, because most Black Americans in mass have not come to Mexico City except for in the last like maybe like 5 to 7 years, mostly driven by the pandemic.
Yeah, the pandemic opened up a lot of opportunities for people. Yeah. I think it was a wake-up call in a lot of respects, where the hamster wheel stopped spinning long enough for people to question, why am I doing this job that I hate? Or why am I doing this commute? why am I in this country? You know, just even why, right? Just to ask the question. And for many people, including myself, like it led us in different directions than if we had stayed on that hamster wheel or that treadmill going in the direction as everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, obviously this podcast is called Black Sit Global and I talk to Black expats all over the world. So now that you were talking about this, you know, influx of Black Americans that are coming into Mexico and Mexico City and, you know, whether they're coming for travel or thinking about a long-term commitment, what are some of the things that you are either seeing or hearing as people are coming through Black Citocina?
I think that, well, there's a mix of people who come through Black Citocina. There's, you know, the folks who are from the U.S. who live here now. There are folks who are visiting from the U.S. And then there's like Mexican nationals who are coming, like I said, to this food for the first time and really experiencing the culture and wondering like, why this, why here, you know? I think at least as far as like Black folks from the U.S., a lot of people who are visiting will say like, oh, are there really like a lot of Black people here? And it's like, yeah, actually there are. And honestly, compared to when I first got here, you know, 3 years ago, the amount of like Black produced things to do has just shot up. Because before it was mostly, you know, hangouts and get-togethers at people's houses and like, you know, this thing, but mostly like you had to know the person, you know, who was doing it in order to recognize like, oh, this is the thing that, you know, is happening tonight. But now there's so many people who have come and started their own things. There's so many different parties, so many different Black DJs here. And I think that, again, when you're in a city of 22 million people in a homogenous country, it will, like, to your eye, it might not look like, if you're from Baltimore, you're from D.C. or, you know, somewhere else, it's like has a heavy Atlanta Black population, whatever. It's not going to look like that. But once you start getting into like the WhatsApp groups and you start like kind of meeting people and seeing like, okay, this is where we are, this is what we're doing, then you realize, oh, okay, yeah, there actually are quite a lot of Black people here. There's a lot of like Black stuff happening all the time. So that actually has been incredibly beautiful to witness that. And then also too, because like I said, when I got here, I had never even been to Mexico before. So like, I just kind of like showed up here, like never anywhere in Mexico. And I had been to like 40 something other countries, but in my mind, like Mexico, it's like, oh, it's right there. Like I'll get there. I would rather go to the further place. That's going to be harder for me to like take that time off or to go there, you know? And so when I got here, it really was unexpected what I found. And I just happened to fall in love with it. And I think that a lot of people do. And especially, you know, like I said, folks who are already kind of feeling those feelings of wanting something different, but they're not really sure where, you know, Mexico, I think, is easy for a lot of people just because even if what we're accustomed to is a caricature of Mexican culture, people generally have an understanding of like, okay, Mexico, Spanish, tacos, beach, cumbia, like whatever. So like we have some sort of like in our national psyche understanding of basic Mexican stuff. And so to come down here doesn't really feel like that far of a leap. It's so close to the U.S. And I think for me in the pandemic, that actually was what worked in Mexico's favor because now it's proximity. If something happens to me, if something happens to my family, it's very easy for me to get back and forth from DC to Mexico City. I already speak Spanish. So that's pretty much like all I need to just, you know, try it out and see how things go. And so for me, that has led to a life here. And now I feel like just a full-on immigrant. Like, you know, I came here, I settled, I started my own business. I have a community of friends and family, you know, some of them from the U.S., some of them that are Mexican nationals here. So it's just been really beautiful to build a life that honestly was unexpected.
In so many ways. And that's why I find your story to be so amazing. You know, like you said, you went to Mexico, sight unseen, and then, you know, fast forward in a short amount of time, You've created all of these opportunities, not only for yourself, but you've given back to the community, the Black American community, but also the community in Mexico. And so that has, I feel like that is also a key part of your story, because, you know, when we talk about, you know, moving abroad, oftentimes the conversation leads to, especially now with inflation, you know, gentrification and bringing Western dollars to some of these, you know, developing or underdeveloped countries, and, you know, raising the cost of living and things like that. But I feel, my personal opinion, as Black Americans, especially having been oppressed and been on the receiving end of discrimination for so many years and decades, that we move different than our non-melanated counterparts. And so we're thinking about the impact of where we live on the local community. And for some that are, you know, entrepreneurial like yourself, it's a bigger picture.
Yeah, I mostly agree with that. I want to believe that everybody comes with good intentions, especially Black folks, because of the generations of oppression and marginalization and like all the things we face, racism. So I think that I have a lot more empathy for Black people who feel like the U.S. is not for them. I understand why we feel that way. But also, again, we have that education. We've lived it. Our families through the generations have lived it. But when you come to a place that has no idea of that, and in fact, their idea of what the U.S. is based off of the news or Hollywood or whatever, they're like, why would you want to come here? You know, like, this place seems so, I don't want to say, like, put words in people's mouth, but like, this place doesn't seem as ideal as the situation that you left. So why do you want to be here? And then also too, there's some folks, like, even Black folks, like, I'm lying, like, some people come here with their privilege and they are just as ignorant and they act like not the best version of what I would like for Mexicans to see of Black people from the U.S., or anyone from the U.S. for that matter, regardless of whatever color they are. And so I do think that it is true that, like, yes, mostly I would say Black people move a certain way, but we also have that history, have that understanding. Most other people don't have that. They are not taught that stuff in schools, for sure. And most people aren't even really thinking about, especially down here, maybe closer to the border and stuff, they have more of an understanding of, like, the U.S. and different, like, racial groups that comprise the U.S. But down here, most people do not think of, like, the U.S. at all, really. Not in any significant way. Like, maybe, I mean, I think that the U.S. is ingrained in the culture a lot here, but just in terms of, like, the identity politics of the U.S., they're not thinking about the U.S. in that way. And so when you come down here, and it's happened to me plenty, not that often, but, like, especially as, like, Black Scocina has become, like, people become more aware of it, there's, you know, Mexican folks who would be like, oh, this is gentrification, this is this, like, you know, and they talk about me the same way they would talk about a white person from the U.S. And for me, it's just like, you know, I understand what it's like to not be able to afford to live where you grew up. I do understand that. I also know that in both cases, the landlords of my apartment and of the restaurant are Mexican. So you're your own people. The call is coming from inside the house. So again, y'all are upset about the gentrification and everything, and I understand that. I completely get it. Here's what I know. I speak the language. I'm respectful of the culture. I'm working to create opportunities for economic opportunities for Mexicans that otherwise would not be paid as well or taken care of as well as they would with any other employer. I have witnessed some Mexicans that have told me about their struggles with their job. And, like, you know, you would think for the country with as many worker protections as they have, that people wouldn't get screwed over the way they are sometimes. But sometimes it's like, it'd be your own people. And it's just like, that really is unfortunate, but I can't control that. What I can control is me. And if you come to work for me, I'm going to give you a dignified workplace. You can count on it. You can ask anybody who works for me. I pay on time, in full. I don't ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. And so I have created an environment that, like I said, is a dignified, respectful workplace. And you would rather have 10 of me if your city is going to be gentrified than have one of somebody who is the opposite of that and just coming here and extracting and not actually taking part in the community that's around them.
Well said. So outside of the food, what else goes on at Black Sickle Cena? What else can people expect when they come?
You know, when I wrote the business plan for Black Sickle Cena events was probably like two paragraphs. It wasn't something I spent a whole lot of time on, but it has really been our bread and butter, especially as we get people going, learning about what we're doing and, you know, what is being built here. So we have so many events and it's crazy to think about it, but, you know, Very Black Trivia, that is always so fun. We're doing Diva karaoke. We're calling it like St. Patty's Day, but it's really about Patti LaBelle. And we're doing like a Diva karaoke night this Sunday coming up for St. Patrick's Day, because like who really cares about St. Patrick's?
I love it.
That last year, somebody was like, and this is kind of like an example of like some of the ignorant stuff, like Cinco de Mayo is not something that is celebrated here. It's not something that people even really think about like that. In the U.S., it's just become commercialized and like a reason to get Tex-Mex and take shots and do all that stuff. Somebody came to me last year and was like, oh, how come you don't do something for Cinco de Mayo? Like, so many people are going to be looking for stuff to do. And I'm like, look, I will give you that people will be looking for something to do because they don't know better, but I am not going to be that gringo that does a Cinco de Mayo party in Mexico, knowing that that is not something that is like culturally appropriate. And it might even be cultural appropriation. And I'm not going down that road, you know? So anyway, instead of doing a Cinco de Mayo party, we actually ended up doing trap brunch. And this was like before we had brunch on the regular, like on the regular schedule. Now we have brunch all the time, but we did trap brunch and that was so fun. It was crazy. It was just like, it was so Black. It was so turned, like it was so fun. And I just like imagine to, you know, like if you lived in this neighborhood your whole life and you just like ride your bike down the street, and you see all these Black people with the hip hop blaring and everybody's like drinking and just like enjoying each other and just vibing. Like we look like aliens, you know, like to a lot of people it feels like. But that's kind of like what Black Sickle Cena is. It's a gathering space. It's a community space. It's a space that it's for, I would say it actually really is for everybody who appreciates Blackness and wants an authentic experience of Blackness in Mexico City. But I'm doing this, I'm building something with the Black experience in mind and like what I knew and what I grew up with in mind. But it really is a place where everybody can come and like enjoy what we have to offer, regardless of if you're Black or not.
That's powerful. I love it. And I'm ready to book a plane ticket. All I need is my residency card to show up in the mail so I can get up out of here for a little bit. So you have been evolving as an entrepreneur as well as, you know, an immigrant. And recently I saw you were on a panel and you were speaking Spanish.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That was so, it was good for me. It's good to do scary things. And speaking Spanish at a U.S. embassy event in public on stage. Oh my God. Yeah, that was crazy, but I'm glad I did it.
You do big things. And so I guess the next obvious question is, in, you know, like this big picture, how do you see yourself continuing to evolve? Is it maybe opening up another location for Black Sickle Cena? Is it doing another concept? I'm just curious if you've given thought to how you're continuing to evolve in your journey.
Yeah, well, the first year was just learning a lot about all the things that I didn't know and just kind of adapting and figuring out. That stuff still happens, but less so. So I feel like year two is pretty much refining systems. I finally found like, you know, an accounting and HR firm that is like stellar, amazing. I love them so much. And so just getting like the books right, understanding more about the business and things we're doing well and what, you know, we can afford to keep working on or just, you know, stop doing completely. So that's really what this year is about, the first, I would say, 6 months of this year. And then after that, you know, for whatever the last Q3, Q4, I would like to start focusing on finding like investors, because this, again, this is something that I think a lot of people don't always talk about. I haven't heard it talked about so much from like the perspective of like a Black woman or a Black person like moving abroad, opening up a a business in a foreign country. But this is not, Bicycle Scene is not a generational wealth story. There was no investors early on. When I tell you that, you know, the savings that I had, and honestly, those 9 months that I moved down here when I had a corporate job, and like my employers didn't know I was down here, I could have been falling out. The dollar was actually doing a lot better than it was or than it is currently. But I decided to live within my means. And for me, that was, I'm going to live on 50% of my paycheck and I'm going to put the other 50% away religiously. And so I did do that. And I had like a 6 month emergency savings by the time I got laid off, which was great. And then I was very fortunate that I got a freelance job that honestly, two of them that really helped me have the money to build back Bicycle Scene as I was like living off of this like emergency fund that I had. But I think I opened Bicycle Scene like really like liquid cash with $20,000. And then besides that, it was credit. I'm not about to tell you that I've drained a lot of like my finances now doing this. Again, I took a chance on myself, and I think that it's very easy for a lot of people to say like, oh, you never open a business with your own money, use other people's money. That's something that like, I feel like a lot of, I've heard mostly from like white folks or people that have like some sort of privilege. So I'm like, who is going to tell a Black woman, like open up their checkbook and just write me a check to build a restaurant in a country that I don't even like at the time, I just had a temporary residency, whatever. Like, I don't have any connection to this country at all. Yes, I speak Spanish, but not fluently. I've never run a restaurant before. I've hardly even worked in a restaurant. Like, nobody is opening their wallet to me and saying like, yeah, here's X amount of money, go do that thing. So I had to build it for myself. And now that it's been going and I've been able to do it successfully with all those factors, in some ways, I would say some people would say working against me. I say in some ways working in my favor, because it just allowed me to just, without any overthink or too much overthinking, just do the thing. I have been able to build this thing, and it is successful, and you can see how it's growing and people are finding out about it. And now it's time to like take it to the next level, and I can only do so much myself. So that is definitely year two goals. And then besides that, I've thought about possibly opening another spot, but that's a little bit further down the road. I think right now I want to focus on expanding the hours where we currently are, but maybe having some different offerings. And one of those that I'm working on is working with folks from the Haitian diaspora community that's here, because there's a lot of folks coming with all the things that are going on, have been going on in Haiti, and especially right now. And people need opportunity. And so I've already been working with like two folks that I met just in my path, like in every sense of that word. They were in the park as I was walking to the restaurant, and I just like was like, Sampa say, like, I don't even know that much Haitian Creole, but I know that. And so that just started like a beautiful friendship and exchange of like food and culture. And so we're working to do some like Haitian food pop-ups at Black Scocina, which I hope will be sort of like an incubator for doing something else that's, you know, could be its own thing. Because I have very vivid memories of sitting on the roof of my place 3 years ago, talking to my friend who's Haitian from Miami, and him being like, I really love it here, but there's no Caribbean food. There's not like a lot of Caribbean food. There's definitely no Haitian food. Nothing that like reminds me of my culture and home here. And that was 3 years ago. And I feel like I've been building Black Scocina and just kind of watching to see like, okay, all these Black people are coming to Mexico. Who's going to open up a Haitian or whatever, any kind of like Caribbean food here? And we have like, I think like there was somebody before Teresa from La Jamaquina that was doing like pop-ups. And we have like somebody else who's kind of doing some Jamaican food pop-ups. So there's been like little things here and there, but there's no like physical space to go and get that kind of food on a regular basis. And so I'm like, well, if nobody's going to do it and I can do something to help support, you know, a community in need, which they are, the Haitian diaspora community here, then I want to do that. And I think that that's huge to be able to offer somebody an economic lifeline that is going to have ripple effects, not just here, but for their family back in Haiti or, you know, like wherever they have family. So that's something that I'm really excited about and something that I feel passionate about. On that note about, you know, working with the Haitian community here, and I'm not, I say that broadly, but there's like two people that I've been working on because I really wanted to, again, like focus on giving just two people an opportunity. I'm working right now on a campaign to be able to help these folks get legal help to be able to like set up their Mexican bank accounts and their get their national ID and all of these things. And so the immigration lawyer who helped me not only establish my business, but get my business to sponsor my work visa, she has offered to discount her services 75%. So that way we can help these two people get set up. And so I'm going to be starting a GoFundMe page for them and these services. And we actually really only need $2,000 for these two people. And that's, again, with the discount, like the, you know, in-kind work that my lawyer is doing. And so that really isn't that much money. And I think that, you know, whatever extra money that comes from that, we can just pass it forward. They're here with some cousins, you know, just helping people get established. And there's just a lot of folks that, you know, that need a leg up. And I think that that's something that I'm in a position to do. It's something that I would love to be able to do. And so that is something that I'm really excited about that we're working on now. And also is really like getting the juice creatively to do it, because Black Cocina is a restaurant, is a lot of work, and people don't really understand that. I think there's an expectation that, you know, I'm back in the kitchen cooking everybody's meal and it's going to taste like exactly the way, you know, the soul food back home, wherever you're from, taste, but it just doesn't work that way. Like, you know, we talked about like challenges initially. Well, also like for people being from a culture, again, that's homogenous, where they have a national cuisine, the folks who are working in my kitchen are Mexicans, and they didn't grow up with these flavors. Like, they're learning something new as well. And these aren't like chefs or culinary students. Like, these are like everyday people who have some kitchen experience or maybe none at all. And I'm working with them to train them the best that I can to be able to recreate these flavors. But for us growing up eating this food, it almost feels inherent. Like, this is what you know. It's the same thing for them, but with Mexican food. So them learning something else is going to take some time. And I think that people kind of underestimate that that's, you know, a huge learning curve, teaching the kitchen how to be able to do this, because I can't run the restaurant, be in the kitchen, make drinks, greet people, deal with the vendor who's coming in, you know, like have a conversation with a neighbor. There's a lot of hats that I have to wear as well. And so it really becomes a thing where I have to train and rely on my team to be able to execute this food and this experience the way I envision it.
There's no doubt that Black Cocina is going to continue to succeed. And I love the serendipity in your journey. So I'm confident that somebody who's listening to this episode is going to come into your universe and help you manifest all the things that you want. I want to piggyback on one thing before we end. You were talking about wanting to seek investors. Is that something that you have set up right now, or if somebody who's listening to this loves what they hear, loves what you're all about and wants to support, how can they do so?
Yeah, so right now I'm currently, like, I've been like working on getting a crowdfunding campaign going for forever. So I would say right now what people can do is just reach out to me directly, whether that's on Instagram or blacksicocina@gmail.com. Send me a message. But yeah, I hope that the crowdfund campaign will also happen sometime in the next 3 months or something like that. So I think that that's one of the easiest ways to support. I mean, or if you just want to support before the crowdfund campaign comes up, like, just, you know, shoot me a little something on Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, whatever you need. I'll find a way to get it. I definitely appreciate it. you know, people are like, how come you don't have biscuits? I'm like, well, because we don't have an oven big enough. And so right now the choice is making your cornbread or putting the nachos in the bake or doing whatever. So we can't have everything. But if we had, you know, that investment or, you know, a little bit extra cash to be able to buy some things that would help us improve the experience, and we can do some of that stuff. But I think that a lot of the things that people ask for, there's a reason why it's not on the menu. And it's probably has something to do with the logistics of the kitchen and not being able to execute it properly. And something like a biscuit, I know people will judge a soul food restaurant hard on that biscuit. So I'm just not going to do it if I can't do it, you know, the way it should be done. So, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, investors, everyday people donating to us, like that is a type of investment as well. You do not have to be somebody who has thousands of dollars or whatever to give, to be an investor, to be a supporter. And besides that, I think also I'm looking for, you know, a head chef to work with so I can kind of step away from the kitchen, not entirely, but just enough to be able to focus on the service side, this crowdfunding campaign, going after investors, doing pop-ups in other places. But right now I feel very tied to the restaurant because I have to be in order to make things run, you know, like I said, the way I envision. So all of that stuff is so, so important. And, you know, I think also just kind of going back to your question about expansion, the building that we're in definitely has some opportunities for us to grow and make the space bigger. But also too, I think it would be really cool to like get a food truck, you know, and make ourselves mobile. There's a lot of like catering opportunities and things like that that I haven't really been able to do because I just don't have the capacity. I don't have a car, like, you know, all these things that I think a lot of us kind of take for granted. You don't just pop up somewhere and build a whole kitchen and, you know, food comes out. Like that stuff takes a whole team, organized team. And that's just not where we are right now in our journey, but it's something that I definitely have in mind and would like to see us capitalize on in the near future.
Yeah, it's running a business as the owner requires that you wear many hats. And yeah. I love how you articulated all of the things that you do, because it is important to demystify it so that people don't think like, oh, you came up with this. Oh, you just got buckets of money in the back and you can do all these things. Like, you're very intentional. That's what I hear as a thread in your story. One, you take risks, but two, you're very intentional in how you move about. And so anyone who's listening, whether, you know, it's a little money or a lot of money, you can take action now to support Tierra. We could, and go visit if you're in Mexico City. Go patronize Blacksicle Cena. Help support a Black-owned small business.
Yeah, like our stuff on Instagram, share it, you know, comment on it. Just do all the things to make the algorithm do what it do so we can, you know, people knowing about what we have going on, and all of that helps in our journey to expanding and making the restaurant resilient and strong.
Absolutely. So as we end, Tierra, where can people find you?
We are on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and if you just Google Blacksicle Cena, there's a bunch of different things that will come up. But yeah, just look for Blacksicle Cena on all of those platforms and you'll find us.
Awesome. I will link all of that in the show notes for this episode. And with that, I want to thank you for being a guest on the Blacksicle Global Podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and getting to know you and your backstory, but also the marvelous work that you're doing in Mexico City. Like I said, for us, as well as for the locals in Mexico City. And I know that everything that you want, I have no doubt in my mind, hearing all of the remarkable things that have manifested in your life thus far, I have no doubt that anything that you put your mind to it, you will accomplish. So with that, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Blacksicle Global Podcast. For more information on today's episode, be sure to visit our website at blacksicleglobal.com. It's not only possible to live out your dreams unbothered and in full color, it is your birthright. Are you trying to sort out health plans, banking, VPN, and other connectivity for your move abroad? Well, have no fear. We've got you with the Move Abroad Starter Kit. Get yours today at blacksitglobal.com/resources. That's blacksitglobal.com/resources.